It's Wednesday, November 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, Turkey shoots down a Russian fighter jet. The debate rages in the United States about Syrian refugees.
Actually, it's surprisingly easy to go as a tourist to North Korea.
Also ahead, a rare glimpse inside of North Korea, and a new film considers how we age. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Russian President Vladimir Putin acknowledged a Russian jet has been shot down by a Turkish F-16 after Russian officials had earlier said firing from the ground was responsible for downing the plane. But he said the fighter was over Syrian territory 1 kilometer away from the Turkish border when it was hit, and it never threatened Turkey. Putin said Russia had long noted a large amount of oil and oil products entering Turkey from Islamic State-held territory in Syria, providing the terrorist group with a large money supply. He added that today's tragic event will have serious consequences for Russian-Turkish relations. VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Sharif joins us with the latest.
The Russian Ministry of Defense has come out saying that one of the pilots was killed as he was descending after they had ejected from the plane. They say that he was shot by ground fire, presumably from Turkmen rebels who were operating in the area. They haven't given any word at all on the other pilot. There was a search and rescue operation taking place, but one of the helicopters that was involved in the search and rescue was also shot at and had to make an emergency landing. It was essentially shot down. And during the search and rescue operation, Russia's Ministry of Defense says one other Russian contract marine was killed in a firefight, apparently. At least that's what they implied. And the others who were involved in the search and rescue were evacuated, and the Ministry of Defense says that they're being treated for minor injuries.
Russia says, of course, it was operating in Syrian airspace. Turkey says that it had contacted the Russian jet several times for several minutes before firing at it, saying that it was encroaching in Turkish airspace. President Putin has really come out with a harsh comment against Turkey.
Yeah, he has. I mean, he's come out very clearly saying that this was a stab in the back by Turkey, that Turkey is associating with, supporting terrorism with its actions. Yeah, also the Ministry of Defense had some very strong denials, saying that there was no attempt, according to them, by the Turkish side to contact their jet, either by communications or visually. So they're just two completely different sides, two different versions of events completely.
President Obama, after meeting with French President François Hollande here in Washington, came out and said that Turkey has a right to defend its airspace. And President Hollande has an upcoming meeting with Putin, which I'm sure now is going to become quite interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. There's going to be a lot of interest in exactly what kind of message the French president will be bringing to President Putin when they meet here in Moscow on Thursday. He had made it clear in his comments with President Obama that he would be saying there could be no real alliance with Russia until Russia really focuses on fighting against the Islamic State. From the beginning of this conflict, when Russia entered the conflict in September, there has been a lot of evidence and a lot of accusations that Russia has been bombing opponents of the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad rather than focusing on Islamic State or other terrorists operating inside Syria. Moscow, of course, has been saying that they're going after terrorists, but they do lump just about everybody into the category of terrorists who doesn't happen to be fighting with the Syrian army. So that's really the contention, and it'll be interesting to see what happens when President Hollande is here and whether or not they can come to any sort of real cooperation other than declarations that everybody opposes terrorism.
Daniel Sharif is our correspondent in Moscow, and I know you've stayed up very late to speak with us. Daniel, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said that he's canceled a planned visit to Turkey and says that his ministry is recommending that Russians not travel to Turkey for tourism or any other purposes. We turn now to our social media segment, International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here in Studio 22 to tell us what's buzzing online. And we begin with the latest travel alert from the State Department. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. The State Department's Bureau of Consular Affairs sent out this tweet. Travel alert. Authorities believe likelihood of terror attacks will continue as ISIL/Daesh return from Syria and Iraq. The tweet included a link to the full text of the alert. The Bureau is on Twitter at TravelGOV, but many people have tweeted the latest alert is not specific enough.
I've heard that too. So what does it advise people to do exactly?
There are four bullet points. First, it recommends Americans traveling abroad to follow instructions of local authorities and to monitor media and local information sources. Second and third recommendations are about preparing for additional security screening and staying in touch with family members so they can reach you in case of an emergency. The last recommendation is to register with the state's Smart Traveler Enrollment Program, also known as STEP.
Well, that's probably the only recommendation that's not just common sense. So what is the STEP program?
It's a free service that allows Americans traveling abroad to enroll their trip with the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate. Now, once you're enrolled, you can receive information about safety conditions in your destination, and it's easier for the embassy and your family to reach you in case of an emergency. Jim, before I go, I want to also introduce a company that's helping people adopt cats and dogs this holiday season.
Sure. What company is it?
It's the online retailer Zappos. The company announced it will cover adoption fees from Black Friday through Cyber Monday. It partnered with the Best Friends Animal Society and will donate $150 to cover adoption fees for every single adoption. Details are on their website. That's all for me today.
All right. Give them a good home. Thanks for being here. G. Abby Lee's home's here in Studio 22 and on Twitter. She tweets for our VOA International Edition account at @VOA_IE. You can follow her on her own account at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. New U.S. opinion polls show a majority of Americans oppose bringing more Syrian refugees into the country, and many Republican lawmakers and state governors, as well as some Democrats, say refugee vetting procedures should be tightened to prevent Islamic State terrorists from sneaking in. Supporters of the refugees accuse Republicans of being anti-Muslim, given that most of the refugees are in fact Muslims. And that debate was the focus of this week's hashtag VOA TV show. Its host is Michael Lippin. He's right here in our studio.
I'm here,
Hello,
Jen.
Michael.
Hi. Well, I wanted to let you know that one of the panelists on our show today was a representative of the Syrian American Council. Suzanne Meriden told me that her group is trying to persuade Republicans to give the refugees a chance.
We've actually started this initiative to go out to the governors. We've sent out invite letters saying, let's have you meet with these refugees so you can get to know them. So unfortunately, this whole refugee issue, a lot of people are using it as a plateau for their own political agendas. We want to bring the human part back into it. If some of these governors that are saying no to the refugees meet the people, get to know them, hear the real stories, then they would be more open to understand that these people do need refuge. So we actually are doing press conferences across the United States because we have chapters across. So they're helping us put together these press conferences, and we're calling for an invite, and we hope the governors governors react, respond, and meet these refugees along with us.
Have you had any responses yet to those appeals?
So we know we're getting a response soon from the Maryland governor. We're waiting to hear what that is, but we feel good about it, and we feel positive, and we're hoping that we can get those meetings happen.
Well, now, I also spoke on the show to Jenny Yang of World Relief, which is the humanitarian arm of the U.S. National Association of Evangelical Christians. I asked her what she thinks of Republican arguments that the U.S. should welcome Syrian Christian refugees rather than Muslims because Christians in particular are suffering religious persecution by Islamic State. Here's what Jenny Yang said.
I do think we need to help religious minorities in the Middle East, including Christians, but helping Christians doesn't mean it has to come at the expense of other refugees, like Muslims who are also persecuted. The hallmark of the U.S. resettlement program is that we accept the most vulnerable refugees, regardless of their nationality or religion, and I think that it should remain that way. We have a strong tradition of welcoming any and all, and we resettle less than 1% of the world's refugees, which means that we really need to welcome the most vulnerable.
And in terms of welcoming refugees, there are some conservative groups in America, like the Center for Immigration Studies, who say that the cost to American taxpayers of bringing refugees in is quite high because refugees require a lot of care. They require help to find jobs. Some of them end up on welfare. And they look at the aid that we send overseas and say, maybe we should better spend that money on Syrian refugees where they are in the region. What do you think of that argument?
The numbers that we're talking about in the United States, it's only 10,000 over the next year, which is a drop in the bucket compared to what our allies in the region are facing. So to say that we can accept 10,000 is not a huge number. And also, we work with communities all across the country that are welcoming them, businesses that employ refugees, faith communities that want to welcome them as an expression of their faith. So there is a lot of community support for refugees. We're not just putting them in places where they wouldn't be welcome.
Well, for more on that discussion, you can watch the show on our hashtag VOA Facebook page. Jim?
And definitely check it out. It is a great program, hashtag VOA. Thanks so much for joining us,
Michael. I like it too. Thanks, Jim.
North Korea's leader is believed to have sent one of his top aides to a farm for re-education over the poor construction of a power plant near the North Korean border with China. Cho Rong-hae is a top advisor to leader Kim Jong-un and is reported to have been sent away earlier this month. Life in North Korea remains a mystery to many in the West, but a few have gained an inside glimpse, like photographer Christian Peterson-Clausen, who works for nknews.org. In the first of three parts, he tells us about his interest in the Hermit Kingdom and basic travels there.
The reason I was interested initially in North Korea is I'm a German, and I grew up in what was then West Germany, and I was 13 when the Berlin Wall fell, and so after that, I, you know, had a lot of former East German friends, obviously, and they would always tell me what it was like growing up in the East. You know, in Germany, they were all watched West German TV back then, so they knew what we had and what they didn't have. And they would always tell how life was much more harder, much more standing in line, much more, you know, missing things. And I really wanted to know what life for the average North Korean was like, if it was similar to that or if they had a totally different life experience over there. And that's the reason I initially wanted to go to North Korea.
I have heard comparisons between East and West Germany, North and South Korea, in terms of the reunification efforts and some of the things that the Koreans might be going through should they actually get to that point. What were conditions like that you saw? I understand most tourists end up just in Pyongyang.
Yeah, you can go into different places. Actually, it's surprisingly easy to go as a tourist to North Korea. And they are very keen on getting you there because, of course, they want hard Western currency. It is possible to go up to the north, to Mount Paektu, to other cities. I have actually been to Pyeongsong, which is a trading city where many people who do trade with China live, and many, many, you know, private business owners, legal private business owners. Because as you know, in North Korea in general, private business is not permitted, right? And so these people have special permits to do state-owned government private corporations. That is really, really interesting because the North Korean state is completely unable to provide for the necessities of everyday life of their citizens. A government paycheck will not even buy you a pack of cigarettes.
And so everybody from, you know, the lowest ranks of the social ladder to almost the elite has a private job on the side, is making private money. And so that is something that happened in East Germany after the wall fell, when all the government, the state-owned businesses collapsed because they couldn't compete in a Western society. In North Korea, it has already happened.
How did you find life different between these areas of North Korea?
Pyongyang is a, for North Korea, very privileged place. It is a place where you have roads that are comparatively better, even though they're in no way up to Western standards. The power is pretty constant. Outages, I was told, are fairly minimal. And they do have what they would consider the very upscale kind of neighborhoods. Once you go out of Pyongyang, pretty much the whole country has roads that are so bad that at best you can go 20 miles an hour, even on the main highways. It's absolute abject poverty. And then when you drive through villages or even through other cities, you notice that every last place, even, you know, the tiniest nooks and corners around the buildings, is growing edible vegetables. That tells you how worried people are about their own subsistence, how nobody has forgotten the famine over there.
Photographer Christian Pettersen-Clausen, who works for nknews.org, join us tomorrow for part two of our conversation. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
A new film from Academy Award-winning director Paolo Sorrentino, Youth, looks at aging and how some of life's most profound events can happen at any time. International Edition's David Byrd has this look at the film, which stars Oscar winners Michael Caine, Jane Fonda, and Rachel Weisz.
Daddy, you will not be bored because I have arranged the full service for you. You're going to have a massage, a sauna, checkups with the doctor every single day to help you get back in shape.
At my age, getting in shape is merely a waste of time.
Oh, God, you guys have got a strange friendship.
No, it's just a good friendship. And in a good friendship, you only tell each other the good things.
Did you take a piss today?
4 drops.
You? Same. More or less.
More or less.
Yes. Fred Ballinger and Mick Boyle are best friends and septuagenarians. They are on vacation in the Swiss Alps when Fred, a composer played by Michael Caine, gets an invitation from Buckingham Palace to perform his work Simple Songs for Prince Philip's birthday. Fred turns down the offer, saying he's not interested in performing anymore, even though he is composing music in his head when he's alone. Mick, played by Oscar nominee Harvey Keitel, is writing the screenplay for what he expects to be his last film. Mick completes the screenplay and wants aging diva Brenda Morell, played by 2-time Oscar winner Jane Fonda, to star in it. But she turns him down. Youth is the second English-language film from Academy Award winner Paolo Sorrentino, who directed 2013's Best Foreign Language winner, The Great Beauty. At the premiere in Los Angeles, Sorrentino said he wrote the film with Caine in mind.
Youth is a perception that you can have in the life. So the idea of youth can belong also to the old people. Not the youth in the body, but the youth in the mind, the youth in the perception of the freedom that you can have in the future.
Jane Fonda said that youth explores what it means to be young, in mind and spirit, if not in body.
Aging really has more to do with spirit and passion and staying open and not becoming cynical, staying curious, more than the number of years you've been alive.
Michael Caine says that the movie offers hope, the hope of a full life, regardless of chronological age.
It's saying to old people, don't be afraid. And it's saying to young people, don't be afraid. It's okay. It's all right. And I remember a line that I said in the doctor's. He says to me, how do you feel about being old? And I said, I don't understand how I got here. But the great thing about being old is you got here.
Music is all I understand, because you don't need words and experience to understand it. It just is.
The movie also features Rachel Weisz as Fred's daughter and assistant Lena, who wants her father to take the job for the royal family, even though he says that he can't because only his wife, who is now incapacitated, can sing the soprano role. Youth also stars Paul Dano as Jimmy Tree, an actor researching an upcoming role, and features an appearance by former Argentine soccer star Diego Maradona as Raleigh Serrano. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. We reside on our website. It's voanews.com. Click on it any time of the day or night to hear our program or many of the other great programs we offer. We're also on Twitter. Follow us at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Aydin Utku. I'm Jim Stevenson, and we're in Washington. We thank you so much for being with us today and invite you to come back and visit again tomorrow. Have a super day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the November 14th meeting of the International Syria Support Group in Vienna, members expressed a unanimous sense of urgency to end the suffering of the Syrian people, the destabilization of the region, and the resulting increase in terrorists like Daesh, drawn to the fighting in Syria. To advance a diplomatic solution to the horrific civil war, the parties agreed on concrete steps to advance a nationwide ceasefire and a political process in accordance with the Geneva Communique of June 2012. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke of what was accomplished in Vienna.
So for the first time, we got people to sit down at the table, and everybody, including Iran and including Russia, signed on to a communique that said, we all want a united Syria. We all want a secular Syria. We all want a Syria in which the minorities are fully protected and there is tolerance and respect for different religions and different cultures.
But both Secretary of State Kerry and President Barack Obama have emphasized that the war in Syria will not end as long as Syrian President Bashar al-Assad remains in power. It is Assad's brutality against the Syrian people that continues to draw terrorists like Daesh to Syria and help them to flourish. And, as Secretary of State Kerry has noted, Assad has cut his own deal with Daesh.
The Daesh headquarters sat in Raqqa for years. It was never bombed by his bombs. It was children and women in hospitals and schools that were bombed by his bombs.
President Barack Obama said that if Assad continues in power, it is unimaginable that the civil war in Syria will stop when the overwhelming majority of people in Syria consider him to be a brutal, murderous dictator. He cannot regain legitimacy. Mr. Obama said that Assad's allies, Russia and Iran, are going to have to make a fundamental choice, either to continue to prop up Assad or to save the Syrian state and work with the international community and the UN to find a government that truly can be legitimate. The ongoing talks on Syria, President Obama said, create the space needed for Russia and Iran, among others, to make the pivot necessary to help end the war in Syria and assist the world in uniting against the lethal threat posed by Daesh.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.